This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This week, we're featuring some of our most entertaining interviews of the year. This year, we were lucky enough to have Stephen Sondheim on our show twice. First, to celebrate his 80th birthday, then to mark the publication of his book, Finishing the Hat, which collects his lyrics from 1954 to 1981 and tells the stories behind the songs. Sondheim is the greatest Broadway composer, lyricist of our time, and one of the best and most musically innovative ever. Sondheim got his start on Broadway as the lyricist for West Side Story and Gypsy. Then he went on to write words and music for such shows as Anyone Can Whistle, Company, Follies, A Little Night Music, which is back on Broadway, Sweeney Todd, Sunday in the Park with George, Into the Woods, Assassin's Passion, and Roadshow. We're going to hear the interview I recorded with him in April when the Roundabout Theater was presenting the show Sondheim on Sondheim, a review featuring his songs as well as video clips of interviews with him. In the Roundabout Theater production of Sondheim on Sondheim, you say that people assume that a lot of your songs are really autobiographical, but they're not, with the exception of Opening Doors from your 1981 show Merrily We Roll Along. And I saw a revival of the show a few years ago. It didn't last long, sadly, on Broadway. But I saw a revival by the York Theater Company.
Yes.
It was wonderful. I love the show, and I love the songs from the show. So I want to play Opening Doors, and then I want to talk a little bit about it. And
okay.
Do you want to describe where the song fits into the story?
Yes, the song takes place over a period of 2 years in the lives of the three leading players who are in their late 20s. And two of them are songwriters, a lyricist and a composer. And their best friend is a young woman who is a budding novelist. And it's the three of them trying to break into, well, the two guys into show business. And she's trying to finish writing a book.
So this song is at the point where they're kind of hoping to become real, you know, a real composer, a real lyricist, and a real novelist.
They're opening doors.
They're opening doors. And we're going to hear this song by, in the original cast recording, sung by Jim Walton, Lonnie Price, and the part of the producer who interjects in the middle here will be sung by Jason Alexander, who played George on Seinfeld. So here we go from Stephen Sondheim's Merrily We Roll Along.
Bum, bum, ba, da, 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 da. How's it coming?
Good, you?
Done.
1 minute.
Amber Gavin.
Hi.
Harry.
Say hello.
Where?
Me.
What's that?
A brand new card to pop up pictures.
What about the book?
What about the book?
Did you give the publisher the book?
Yes,
good.
No.
Mary.
Finished.
Let me call you back.
Bye. This is just a draft.
Right.
Probably it stinks.
Right.
I haven't had the time to do a polish.
Will you sing?
Right. Who wants to live in New York? Who wants the worry, the noise, the dirt, the heat? Who wants the garbage cans clanging in the street? Suddenly I do. They're always popping their cork. I hate that line. The cops, the cabbies, the sales girls up at Saks. You gotta have a real taste for maniacs. Suddenly I do.
That's great. That's swell. The other stuff is well. It isn't every day I hear a score this strong. But fellas, if I may, there's only one thing wrong. There's not a tune you can hum. Not a tune, you go bum 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 da dum. You need a tune to go bum 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 da dum. Give me a melody. Or can't you throw them a crumb? What's wrong with letting them tap their toes a bit? I'll let you know when Stravinsky has a hit. Give me some melody. Ah, sure, I know it's not that kind of show. But can't you have a score that's sort of in between? But play a little more, I'll show you what I mean.
Wants to live in New York. Hated the dirt, the heat, the noise. But ever since I met you, I...
Listen, boys, maybe it's me. But that's just not a hum of a mum of a mum of a bold melody. Write more work hard, leave your name with a girl. Less avant-garde, leave your name with a girl. Just write a plain old melody.
Opening Doors from Merrily We Roll Along by my guest Stephen Sondheim, who said this is his really autobiographical song. So is the part autobiographical where the producer complains that it's not a song you can hum, give me a melody?
Sure. Oh, sure. But it's autobiographical in the general sense. It's, you know, first of all, I didn't have a collaborator. I mean, it's not specifically autobiographical. I wrote my own lyrics, my own music. And the girl is merely an amalgam of people like, particularly, I was very close to Mary Rogers, Dick Rogers' daughter. She became a composer as well as a novelist, as a matter of fact. And of course, Hal Prince, who was a producer and then eventually a director. And we were all very close to each other. It's not specifically based on us, but it's on the ambience of our lives and the speed and the excitement and the disappointment and the triumph, etc. The whole business of hummability, of course, has to do with familiarity. If you hear a tune enough times, you'll hum it. You know, you can. First time I heard the Berg Violin Concerto, I thought, well, what is this noise? And the third time I heard it, I thought, oh, that's interesting. And the fifth time I heard it, I was humming along with it. And I remember being at the intermission of A Little Night Music when it first came out and hearing somebody say, oh, that Weekend in the Country, that's such a catchy tune. Well, you don't know, very few people accused me of writing catchy tunes. And of course it was a catchy tune. She just heard 11 choruses of it. And so of course she could hum it. I've often said familiarity breeds content. The problem with so much music, particularly in those days, was that you went into the theater humming it. You know, if you hum something on first hearing, it might be because it is so immediately memorable, but more likely it's because it reminds you of something else.
Now, the producer sings, "I'll let you know when Stravinsky has a hit." He sings mm-hmm. sarcastically. Now, you studied with the avant-garde composer Milton Babbitt.
Mm-hmm.
When you studied with him, was your ambition Broadway, or was it more?
Oh no, I always wanted to write songs. Well, he's a songwriter manqué. I wanted to learn compositional technique, and that's what I learned from him. But we had 4-hour sessions once a week, and we would spend the first hour analyzing songs by Jerome Kern or by Da Silva Brown and Henderson, the classic songs of the American theater and American movies, and Milton also he wrote songs most of the time. He wrote these extremely forward-looking pieces. He was writing electronic music before anybody ever knew that electronic music existed. But he had this one foot in. In fact, he is, because he's still alive, he's a jazz fan. And he's also got the kind of memory, if you play him a jazz record from 1932, he'll tell you who is playing what instrument. He's remarkable that way. But what we did was we spent an hour, on, songs, and then 3 hours on Beethoven and Bach. And it was all about essentially compositional analysis. But no, I only wanted to write songs. I didn't want to write concert music.
Can you give me an example of an insight you got from Babbitt studying, say, a Jerome Kern song?
Yeah, well, but I'd have to do it with a piano.
One of the things
we analyzed in detail, one of the songs, was All the Things You Are, which has a remarkable harmonic structure in it. Which, among other things, consists of the fact that the tonic chord isn't played until the end of the song, and it goes through a circle of fifths and then breaks the circle of fifths with a tritone, which echoes itself not only in the melody but also in the bass and defines both the key that the song is written in and the key to which it's going, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I've actually reproduced that hour-long analysis he gave me to students I had at Oxford when I taught at Oxford, and it's lodged in my mind because it is a way of approaching when you're trying to hold a song together, how you hold it together harmonically and still make it fresh. Kern was a master at that.
My guest is Stephen Sondheim. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to the interview I recorded last April with Stephen Sondheim. When we left off, we were talking about studying with composer Milton Babbitt. Now, an example of a song that I think is maybe influenced by your experience with new music, your experience with Milton Babbitt, is part of Sweeney Todd. And I'm thinking of the epiphany, especially toward the end, like when Sweeney sings "Full of Joy,"
mm-hmm.
the chords are so dark there is no joy. it is the joy of anger and revenge.
That's the idea.
And it's so discordant. I mean, I just love that section. Are there things that you learned in composition that helped you write that kind of Broadway music?
No more than that helped me write A Little Night Music or A Funny Happened on the Way to the Forum. The principles are exactly the same.
Mm-hmm.
The expressivity is different. Incidentally, I stumbled on that word because discord, what you mean is dissonant. Discordant means mistakes.
Oh, I didn't mean
means,
that.
That's all right. No, so, but yes, it's dissonant because what's going on in Sweeney's head is dissonant. That would be... In fact, I originally didn't bring the number to a hand, but had it end on a sort of on a dissonant chord with some kind of violin harmonics, meaning very, very high, shrill sounds. And Hal Prince said, you know, Len Cariu has worked so hard while he sings that song, you got to give him a hand. So I put a big chord on the end, and that big chord still strikes me as wrong. And so even in the printed copy, that is the piano vocal score that's published, I put two endings in. Those who want to give it a big, nice consonant chord at the end to get a hand from the audience, and those who want to do what I wanted to do, which was to let the thing dribble out into the next scene.
But, you know, the way it is on the Kest recording, it sounds like there's a consonant and a dissonant chord kind of battling each other.
That's correct, and that's exactly what I, and that is very unsettling, and that is exactly the kind of thing that kills a hand. That's precisely what I mean. You're absolutely right. There's a consonant chord and a dissonant chord going on at the same time, one right after the other.
Okay, so let's hear this end of the Epiphany, and this is the moment where Sweeney Todd, the bobber, learns that the judge that sent him away to prison on a life sentence on trumped-up charges had later raped Sweeney's wife and taken Sweeney's daughter as his ward. And Sweeney, at this point, just finding out about this, he's decided to use his razors to take revenge against the judge. And the work he refers to in the song is the work of revenge.
All right, you sir, how about a shave? Come and visit your good friend, Sweeney. You sir, too sir, welcome to the grave. I will have vengeance. I will have salvation. You, sir? No one's in the chair. Come on, come on! Sweeney's waiting. I want you, waiters. You, sir? Anybody? Gentlemen, now don't be shy. Not one man, no, nor ten men, nor a hundred can assuage me. I will have you. I will get him back, even as he gloats. In the meantime, I'll practice on less honorable throats. And my Lucy lies in ashes, and I'll never see my girl again. But the work waits. I'm alive at last, and I'm
That's Len Cariu singing in the original Kest recording of Sweeney Todd. My guest is Stephen Sondheim, and there's a wonderful Sondheim review by the Roundabout Theater Company, currently at Studio 54 in New York. Now, that last note in the song that Len Cariu sings, joy, full of joy,
mm-hmm.
Did you think hard about what that note should be? Because it's not the note that you expect a kind of resolution at the end there, musical resolution. And that go ahead.
If you're not going to have a harmonic resolution, there's no such thing as a melodic resolution. I mean, resolutions are harmonic; they're not melodic. You can put any note with a consonant chord, and even if it happens to be a dissonant note, it's going to feel resolved because you'll feel, you know, as you do with a tonic chord, you'll feel that you're home again, that you've gotten back mm-hmm. to home play. So that note that you call unexpected, I don't think I could put any note there that you would think would be expected because the chord itself doesn't support any note.
That's good. Great. Thank you. I didn't think of it that way. Thank you very much. I should say that song is sung very well by Tom Wopat in Sondheim on Sondheim.
Very scary.
Now, you've also mentioned that there was a Bernard Herrmann influence
Yeah, that's it. You know, when you talked about Milton Babbitt's influence, much less Milton Babbitt's influence than Bernard Herrmann, when I was 15 years old, I saw a movie called Hangover Square, which featured a piano concerto that Bernard Herrmann had written, and it's a melodrama about a serial killer who writes his piano concerto, and it particularly impressed me, but all of Bernard Herrmann's music impressed me, and so actually the score of Sweeney Todd is an homage to him. It's I remember I played the score for the actor Tony Perkins, who knows movie scores the way I knew movie scores, or knew movie scores the way I did. And I wasn't 24 bars into the opening number when he said, "Oh, Bernard Herrmann." So it was very clear that what I was doing was channeling Herrmann. And for the listeners who don't know, Bernard Herrmann did a great many of Alfred Hitchcock's movies, including, of course, Psycho.
Yeah, and the chords in that famous part of the Psycho score are very, like, dissonant violin.
Well, it's not so much the chords, it's the violin effect.
Mm-hmm. You mean like the screechy?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. That's exactly right.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, you've talked about George Gershwin and Harold Arlen as great influences on you, and they were both very influenced by jazz. Did you listen to much jazz or pop when you were in your formative years?
Nope, I didn't, and I'm not very influenced by jazz. First of all, the whole idea of jazz is improvisation and instrumentalists, and because I'm only a piano player and have never played in a band, I don't have a feeling for that. Also, I think by nature I'm too conservative. I only improvise at the piano when I'm writing a song by myself. I never improvise for anybody else or in front of anybody else or at a party or anything like that. And I don't think I would be good at it. I'm much too constrained. It's partly my training. I was my first music teacher, was a professor at Williams College, who was a very, very kind of Mary Poppins kind of teacher with, you know, he laid down the rules, and that appealed to me a lot, the idea of rules of how you write music. That is to say, what music consists of, that it's not just sitting and waiting for an inspiration, but that you take a melodic idea that you have that might be an inspiration, but then you develop it and you work with it and work it out. You don't just fiddle around at the piano to do it. And that appealed to me a lot, but that's very conscious composition, and that's also what I studied with Milton Babbitt. And that is the reverse of jazz. In fact, it's always struck me so odd that Milton, who is so knowledgeable about composition and composes according to a set of rules, some of which he makes up himself, is also such a jazz fan. I can never put those two things together. At any rate, no, I was not influenced by jazz. I was influenced by Gershwin's and Kern's and Arlen's songs, and particularly by their use of harmony.
Can we talk a little bit about your process of songwriting? I know the first thing that comes for you is the story. You only write songs in the context of character and story. But I know this is probably the most often asked question of any songwriter, and they hate to answer it because it's so corny. But really, when you're writing music and lyrics yourself, which comes first for you?
There's no first. Sometimes you get a melodic idea. I sometimes like to, by myself, improvise the piano, sometimes with the script propped up, because I always write after the librettist has started to write a scene or two. I always wait to get so that I can divine and imitate the style that the writer is using, both in terms of dialogue and approach, and getting to know the characters as he is forming them. And we have talked about the scenes and the song for weeks before, but until something's on paper, I have nothing to imitate. And so I sometimes, if looking for a kind of musical atmosphere for the piece, particularly when I'm first beginning to write the piece, I will improvise or think of various melodic ideas and sometimes often harmonic ideas, chord sequences and things like that. So I'm collecting a little kind of the materials for a scrapbook. At the same time, I'm also jotting down any lyric ideas I have, titles or just subject matters or things like that. And then I usually try to start from the first song. And if I have a lyric line or a phrase that seems useful or fruitful, I'll maybe expand on a little bit, but I may do the same thing with the music. I may have a musical idea and expand on a little bit, but I never go very far without bringing the other one in, because you can easily, as you can imagine, paint yourself into a corner. If you write a whole tune or even half a tune and have no idea what you're going to say with it, you're going to be hard-pressed to find words that sit on the music easily and do and accomplish exactly what you want them to do and accomplish. So the thing to do is to do them together or in tandem, but not one and then the other. It's one and then the other at the same time.
We'll hear more of the interview I recorded in April with Stephen Sondheim in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
These are my friends. See how they glisten. See this one shine. How he smiles in the light. My friend, my faithful friend. Speak to me, friend. Whisper, I'll listen. I know you've been locked out of sight all these years. Like me, my friend.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This week, we're featuring some of our most entertaining interviews of the year. Let's get back to the interview I recorded in April with the great composer and lyricist Stephen Sondheim, who turned 80 this year. He wrote the lyrics for West Side Story and Gypsy, then went on to write words and music for such shows as Company, Follies, A Little Night Music, Sweeney Todd, Sunday in the Park with George, and Into the Woods. When we left off, we were talking about his process of songwriting. When you're writing at the piano, are you recording what you're playing, or are you just like
never
notating it?
No, just notating.
Mm-hmm.
There's the process of putting something down on paper is very important, I think, in keeping the stuff alive in your head. You have to make, even if you're just improvising, you have to make little decisions just to put it down on paper. You can improvise a phrase, and as you're putting it down and play it again, you may think, wait a minute, that A flat, that doesn't sound right. And you change things as you go along, even though you're just sketching. It's precisely what an artist does when he's a painter does, or somebody who draws, when he sketches. When you look at, you know, the sketch pads of anybody, you know, Michelangelo or Leonardo, and see how they experiment with, you know, a horse's head or a hand or something like that. That's precisely the analogy. You're putting, you know, a finger on the, or a hand on the music paper before you try to work out a whole body.
Now, when you're working with rhyme, what's your process for figuring out options for rhyming words?
Oh, well, what you use a rhyming dictionary is what you do, and the important thing is to get the thought first, to know what you want to say. And then how you want to phrase what you want to say. And then as the music develops, you'll start to improvise a rhyme scheme or to sense a rhyme scheme. And then if you're, you know, you say, all right, I've got this line that ends with day and I want to say she loves him. So how will I? And then you go through the rhyming dictionary. And I say rhyming dictionaries are useful for rhymes like day. They're not useful for trick rhymes. Those you just think up, you know. But there are so many rhymes for day, and you want something that will somehow encompass or pinpoint what you want to say. There's a rhyme right there. About this situation. And I use a particular rhyming dictionary called the Clement Wood, which the advantage of which is that all the rhymes are listed vertically instead of horizontally. So your eye sweeps up and down the page until a word catches it. The problem with rhyming dictionaries that list things horizontally is that your eye tends, because you start to get impatient, to skip over the words. But when your eye goes up and down a page, you don't skip over as much. And then suddenly a word will pop out and, you know, it'll be bay, and you say, oh, yes, of course. Well, of course, they're on Biscayne Bay. Maybe that'll be useful. So you write that bay is a useful rhyme. And you make a list of rhymes that are in some way relevant to what you're trying to say, and then you use them.
The more you write, do you feel like you've used up rhymes? Can't use a rhyme you've already used to.
Well, that's certain. That's that. No, that's certainly true of any kind of trick or.
Give me an example of the kind of trick rhyme you're talking about.
Oh goodness, I don't know. Soul stirring and bolstering in Follies. You know, if you use that once, you don't use it again. Lottie dottie and nobody. You don't use that more than once, or if you do, you're a fool. And I probably have used it more than once, but I don't think so. So that's what I mean. Whereas, yeah, of course, you're always going to end up rhyming day and may and say over and over and over and over again, you know, from song to song, show to show, because they're useful and they're words that have many meanings and many connotations. And so that's what I mean.
I've heard you singing on recordings that have been released of you singing, and you've said about your own singing that you wish you were more on pitch. And
oh yeah, yes. I never studied singing, and I should have. I do not have a God-given voice of any elegance or. It's musical, but it's not a voice to sing with. And however, I can sing on pitch if I concentrate on it. But often when I'm – all those things that you heard me sing and play were never meant for the public to hear. They were unrehearsed except insofar as I was – there were almost always just private recordings for friends, or they were from auditions that I would give when I would have to go to producers' offices to backers to raise money. And so they were presented in public, but they're being presented by the composer at the piano. So a certain roughness has charm for listeners. There are certain songwriters who have great voices. Sheldon Harnick, Fred Ebb, the lyricist, wonderful voice.
Harold Arlen, Johnny Mercer.
Harold Arlen, well, Johnny Mercer certainly made a career. And Alan Lerner. So a lot of people have really good voices. And some of us do not. The worst voice I ever heard was Leonard Bernstein. That God only withheld one musical talent from Lenny. And that, well, maybe two. But that one, he gave him the voice of a frog. And I don't know if it ever frustrated him or not, but it was agony to listen to him try to sing. It was embarrassing. And the more enthusiastic he got, because what he was trying to do was to substitute passion for vocal acuity, and it was deeply embarrassing. It was kind of cute, but it was embarrassing. And it was when we had to demonstrate any of the songs from West Side Story, I would see to it that I did the singing. And believe me, I'm not that good, but I'm a lot better than Lenny.
In the show Sondheim on Sondheim, the song Finishing the Hat from Sunday in the Park with George is one of the songs that's performed. And about that song, you say that it's about what it's like to come out of the process of making art, to be done with something and then re-enter the world. And I just wonder what it's like for you when you finish with a project and you're out of that art that you've been making and you're both feet are back in the real world. Is the real world like a comfortable or an uncomfortable place for you?
That's not quite the analogy. That's not really exactly what the song's about. The song's about the actual creation. It's about the creative moment. It's about when you are painting a painting or when you are even sometimes when you're writing a letter. You get so intensely involved in what you're doing that you look up and suddenly it's an hour later and you didn't know that an hour had passed. And it's always a shock. That song came out of an incident in my life where I sat down to invent a game for a friend. And I started inventing it 8 o'clock in the evening. And I looked up from my pad because the sun was coming up. And I'd been concentrating for 8 hours. And I know, obviously, I must have gotten up to get something to drink or to go to the bathroom or something. But I have no memory of anything except that. And it's trancing out. And that happens to everybody who either creates for public art or professional art, or as I say, you can get involved in writing a letter. It's about that and getting back in the world. It's not about making a show, which is, after all, a series of those in and out moments. So it's the intensity of that moment, even if it's just 2 minutes, but the intensity. And then with a shock, you look around and you're back in the real world. And It's neither an anticlimax nor a disappointment. It's just a plain old ordinary shock. It's like you've been swimming underwater for a long time. You come up for air, take air, and then you go back underwater again.
I want to end with a song. And I'm going to give you the choice of which one we're going to do. Okay. One is a kind of famous one, Losing My Mind from Follies, sung by Dorothy Collins. And the other is a song from your most recent show, Rocho, formerly known as Balance, formerly known as Wise Guys. And the song is The Best Thing That Ever Has Happened. So which would you
Well,
prefer?
It's hard to pick up. I think I prefer Best Thing That Ever Has Happened because it's less familiar to the listeners to this program than Losing My Mind, which has had a life outside of Follies. Much as it would be wonderful to hear Dorothy Collins sing it again. But I think I'd vote for The Best Thing That Ever Has Happened.
Would you put it in context for us? Tell us where it comes in the show.
Sure.
And something about the writing of the song.
Yeah, well, in the first version of it, which was in the version of the show called Bounce, it was between one of the two leading characters are brothers, Wilson and Addison Meisner. And Wilson was heterosexual and Addison was homosexual. And in the first version, it's Wilson singing to his lady friend, who he eventually is going to marry. And the second one, in Roadshow, we cut that character out because it seemed that the story really is about, if there's any love story in it, it's between the two brothers. And so this is a song now sung by Addison, the homosexual brother, to his young lover. And vice versa. It's a duet between the two guys.
Stephen Sondheim, thank you so much for talking with us.
Sure.
And happy belated 80th birthday.
Thank you, Terry.
First, there's cocktails at the Cosdens.
Oh, Jesus.
Hun, we've got fish to fry.
Why don't you do this one without me, huh?
Then there's dinner at the Dodges, the reception at the Roosevelts.
I think I'm gonna die.
And every party filled with millionaires who want to build the biggest villa since the days of ancient Rome. So what do you say we just stay home?
You are the best thing that ever has happened to me. You are. Okay then, one of the best things that's happened to me. You are. They say we all find love. I never bought it. I never thought it would happen to me. Who could foresee? You are the goddamnedest thing that has happened to me ever. When did I have this much happiness happen to me? Never. I can't believe my luck, and all I can do is be the best thing that's happened to me.
So what do you say we just stay home? What do you say?
A song from Stephen Sondheim's musical Roadshow. The interview we heard was recorded last April. This year, Sondheim turned 80, and he published the book Finishing the Hat, collecting his lyrics from 1954 to 1981 and telling the stories behind the songs. This week, we're featuring some of our most entertaining interviews of the year. Our next interview was one of our most popular. It's about how we keep ourselves entertained, informed, and constantly connected with our digital devices, and how those devices are also distracting us and driving us crazy. With computers, smartphones, apps, we have the potential of being constantly connected just about any place we go. Scientists have been investigating how being constantly plugged in is affecting our brains and our stress levels. Matt Richtel is a technology reporter for the New York Times who's been writing about this new science. He won a Pulitzer Prize this year for his series of articles driven to distraction about the dangers of driving while multitasking with cell phones and other digital devices. We spoke in August. We think when we're multitasking that we're really doing great. We're getting two things done for the price of one, or three things done in the amount of time it should take to do one thing. But what are scientists learning about how efficiently we're doing any of those two or three things when we do them at the same time?
it's pretty clear to scientists you cannot do more than one thing at a time. This research goes back years, and it is having like its new day in the sun, its new applicability. Your brain effectively processes one stream of information at a time. I've heard this very basic test from a Stanford scientist that has stuck with me. It's a kind of cocktail party test that researchers have known about for years, where if you sit in a cocktail party and you're listening to the person in front of you, you can't really listen to the person behind you. In fact, you may pick up very basic things like your name being said if someone says it behind you. But beyond that, you're not processing both those streams of information. So apply that to the person sitting at a desk, fiddling with a device, or trying to read an IM while surfing a website, or talking on the phone to a boss or colleague or subordinate. What you are basically doing is switching rapidly among those tasks, not doing them at the same time. And all the research says, when you switch among those tasks, you cut your effectiveness at each one of them by a significant degree.
I keep wondering, did my brain develop in a different way than children's brains are developing now, because they have different technology than I did when I was growing up?
Terry, you are asking what I think is the question. I mean, this is it's maybe one thing for those of us whose brains are mostly formed, but the frontal lobe of the brain tends to develop last. It is the thing scientists say makes us the most human. There is some thought that the way kids' brains are developing now is different from the way ours developed. This is something I've spent much of the year researching, and I think this frontal lobe question is fascinating. This is the part of the brain that it's the front of the brain. It evolves last. It sets priorities. It helps us balance between and make choices. It essentially says, here's where I'm going to direct my attention at any given time, and it's kind of long-term thinking, long-term goal setting. But it is constantly, if you will, in a simplistic sense, under bombardment from other parts of the brain. The sensory parts that, like, we see something and we send a message to the frontal lobe that says, should I pay attention and how much? When we have an onslaught of data coming in, the sensory cortices of the brain are now constantly bombarding the frontal lobe saying, what should I pay attention to?
Right. And that is so distracting. And it makes it impossible to do the project that you're really trying to do.
And on some level, all this modern technology, what it winds up doing is kind of playing to a very primitive clash between these sensory cortices and the frontal lobe. If you take yourself back millennia and you're in the jungle or you're in the forest and you see a lion, then the lion hits your sensory cortices and says to the frontal lobe, whatever you're doing, whatever hut you're building, stop and run. Well, here's what scientists think is happening in this data era, is that these pings of incoming email, the phone ringing, the buzz in your pocket is almost like we get little tiny lions, little tiny threats, or let's say maybe little tiny rabbits that you want to chase and eat. You get little tiny bursts of adrenaline that are bombarding your frontal lobe, asking you to make choices. But these, in some ways, aren't these modern bombardments. They're the most primitive bombardments. They're playing to these most primitive impulses. And they're asking our brain to make very hard choices a lot.
That's really interesting. Now, I don't know if this relates to what you're saying or not, but here's a paradox for me. I'm driven crazy by email because I feel every time I open it, I'm on everybody else's agenda instead of my own. I'm answering their questions and responding to their needs and doing all these things as opposed to doing the research for my next interview or something. You know what I mean? At the same time, when it's really late at night and I know it's time to go to bed, I'll often say, I wonder what's in my email. And I'll check it one last time because I'm just so curious. And it's hard for me to reconcile that sense of curiosity. I wonder what's there. Maybe it's something interesting. I'd better open it. And the sense of, oh, if I open it, it's going to drive me crazy. There's things I'm going to have to respond to right now. I don't want to. I need to go to sleep, or I need to prepare my interview or whatever. And those things are always clashing in me.
you have illustrated a number of the concepts that underlie the why question. And this is, to me, some of the most fascinating part of what we learned, not only in distracted driving, but that we learned that we're learning this year, which is, given that we recognize attention, that we're having trouble getting things done at some cases, that we're having trouble focusing on the face of the person across from us at the dinner table because we feel the buzz in our pockets, why? Why are you compelled at night to check your device? Do you want to take a shot at that before I start throwing out what some of the research says?
I always think maybe there'll be a little gift there, like some really wonderful message, something like really interesting and fascinating, or somebody I'm dying to hear from.
Terry, you are a winner. You know, if this were like Family Feud, that would be answer one or
what
two.
What did I win? What did I win?
Yeah, you have won an email. You've won an attachment you can't open. Let's break this down between psychological and physiological. You've hit on one of the really interesting psychological reasons people constantly feel compelled to check their devices. And this goes to one of the ideas that psychiatrists think is the most powerful in luring people, and it's called intermittent reinforcement. I'll use a crude analogy. If you have a rat in a cage and the rat doesn't know when a food dispenser is going to dispense a pellet, it feels compelled to check all the time. It creates intermittent reinforcement. You or I or anyone else who doesn't know when something fascinating is going to come by email, when something good is going to come, feel compelled to check all the time. So that would be a psychological lure. And if you take that back again to the primitive analogies that we discussed earlier, you know, you don't know when you're going to get a little rabbit coming in or a little lion. It's not only the positives you're looking for, but you also get stimulated by the threats.
You describe psychological reasons why we check our email even when we don't want to be bombarded by it. Is there like a neurochemical thing going on there too?
Yeah, and these things, I mean, I guess as we all kind of know in life, the brain and the body are hard to differentiate at this point. But let's make that division and say that there's some research out there now that says, for instance, heavy video game use gives you some dopamine release. Dopamine is a chemical that is also thought to be involved with addiction. A lot of this research is still forming, so I want to be careful not to overstep my understanding of this. But the connection that scientists are making are saying basically this. When you check your information, when you get a buzz in your pocket, when you hear a ring, you get what they call a dopamine squirt. You get a little rush of adrenaline. So you're getting that more and more and more and more. Well, guess what happens in its absence? You feel bored. You're actually conditioned by a kind of neurochemical response. Now, I don't want to go too much into the distracted driving thing because, you know, that was something we handled last year. But to me, it's the most powerful manifestation in a way of this concept, because you're behind a 2-ton vehicle and yet you feel compelled to check your device, or you're sitting at a stoplight and you feel bored for a second and you feel compelled to check it. That's a place where you might have a deadly manifestation. Sitting behind your desk, though, as we've talked about the last, you know, hour or so, there are other kinds of manifestations, while not as potentially dangerous, still take their toll.
My guest is Matt Richtel, a technology reporter for The New York Times. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to my interview with Matt Richtel, a technology reporter for The New York Times, who has been writing about how digital technology is affecting our brains, stress levels, and ability to concentrate. You wrote such a great series called Driving While Distracted. This is the series you won the Pulitzer for. And it was all about drivers, you know, texting and using their cell phones while they drive and often getting into accidents as a result. And you looked at all the science behind that and the behavior behind that. Now, here's one of the things that scares me. I don't text while driving, and I try not to dial phone numbers while driving. But I will dial a phone number in a parked spot and then listen through my headset to a call, you know, to somebody on the phone. And I'll think that that's fine. But you've written that science is finding that it's riskier to talk on a cell phone, even with a hands-free device while driving, than it is to talk to a passenger in your car. And it's hard for me to understand what's the difference. I mean, you're still talking and listening. Why is it different if you're doing it on a cell phone than to somebody's in the back seat or the front seat in the same vehicle?
It's not fair to call this nugget trivia, but in some ways, this is the one of the most interesting pieces of trivia I learned in writing that series and that I get asked about the most. The reason is, remember we talked about how you can't process two streams of information at a time. Well, if you're engaged in a phone conversation, even if both hands are on the wheel, you're processing a stream of information. Most times you can get away with that because driving turns out to be, you know, a fairly rote experience. But if something comes into your field of vision, if a kid walks into the roadway unexpectedly, if a car swerves into your lane, you have missed, you have forfeited milliseconds of crucial time to make decisions that would have allowed you otherwise to react. And I did some research for our articles on some really tragic accidents, head-on death collisions, where the researchers tell me they would not have happened if a person hadn't been on a hands-free phone. Now, how is that different, you asked, from talking to a passenger next to you? This kind of gets to that really fascinating nugget I mentioned earlier. It turns out when you're sitting next to someone in a car, that person helps your safety, the research shows, by acting as a second set of eyes. They watch the roadway, they modulate their conversation, both topic and tone, based on what they see in front of them. They tend to get more quiet when the weather gets bad. So rather than being a detractor, like someone on the phone who can't see you or your conditions, they're an advantage.
All right. Well, Matt Richtel, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Terry. I've enjoyed it.
Matt Richtel is a technology reporter for the New York Times. Our interview was recorded last August. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Henry Baldonado, Joan Tuohy-Westman, Sam Brigger, John Myers, John Sheehan, Lauren Krenzel, and Heidi Simon. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.